Welcome, everybody, to this slightly delayed version of the Law of Self-Defense show. My apologies for the slight delay. I was busy putting together a slide deck for today's show, instructional slide deck, just for all of you, and it took me a couple minutes longer than usual. I am attorney self-defense. And we have today what I think will be a pretty interesting show. Based on something that's probably a prank video, I think. But we'll take a look at that. So what we have is we have a video of a man riding a motorcycle down the road, and he's stopped by a pedestrian who compliments him on his bike and then presents a knife, robs the motorcycle rider of his bike. The robber gets on the bike himself. He prepares to take off on the motorcycle, and the rider presents a pistol and shoots the robber in the back. And the question is, what could be the legal justifications for this use of deadly force by the robber? And there's several. Well, there are several legally defensible options here, depending on what state you're in. And we're going to explore what those are. I did have something else I wanted to pull up here. One moment, and then we'll jump into, let's see. Yeah, this one here. Okay. All right. So with that, let's go ahead and start the formal launch of today's show. Not that one. And today's show is presented by none other than Law of Self-Defense ourselves, in the form of our best-selling book, The Law of Self-Defense Principles, written by me, forward by Masad Ayoub. This is your handbook to being hard to convict if you're ever compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, your property. Check it out on Amazon, 5-star rated, bestseller in its category. But don't buy it on Amazon. They'll charge you for the book, $20 or $25, plus shipping and handling. We only ask you to cover the cost of shipping the book to you. The book itself is free at lawofselfdefense.com/freebook or scan that QR code right there. Free. Folks, at lawofselfdefense.com/freebook. All right, so I have this video clip to share with all of you. Let's see, did I export it like I was supposed to? Should be ready to go. And I will say that it looks to me like this is orchestrated, that this is not a genuine robbery on a motorcycle. There's just something about it that makes it seem not very real to me. But for purposes of our discussion today, we will pretend that it's real and explore what the legally defensible... Sorry, folks. What the legally defensible options are for the rider here. So I'll just go play the video straight through.
What's he want?
That's a nice bike, homie.
Yeah.
There's the knife.
What's that?
It's a nice bike. You want to get out the bike for me, homie?
Oh, shit. No, yeah.
Yeah, you're good. Get out the bike.
You're good.
Come on.
So here's the knife. You can see it right there. So it's a felony robbery involving threat of deadly force and a deadly weapon. Rider gets off the bike. Bad guy gets on the bike. Rider presents a pistol. And this is supposed to be when the shots are fired. And then we clip over to the bad guy supposedly laying on the ground there. And the rider gets back on his motorcycle and takes off. So the question for us is, what would be the legally defensible options for this use of deadly force by the rider? And there are several scenarios. under which this could be legally defensible, and they're going to vary by state. Now, I have a little slide deck to pull up here. Let's see how this works. Well, the legally defensible options we're going to be exploring, and the slide got messed up when it got imported into StreamYard. Thanks, StreamYard. Compliance, self-defense, defense against forcible felony, and defense of property. So, compliance. Let's consider compliance first. Compliance, of course, is you just give up the property. You just give up the bike, right? You submit to the robbery. You let the robber escape with your property. And I know plenty of well-intentioned, knowledgeable people who would suggest that compliance is a rational response to a property crime, if you call armed robbery a property crime. All they want is the bike. You give them the bike. They go on their way. Nobody has to die. Your insurance covers the loss of the bike and so forth. But one problem with compliance is that, of course, you're leaving the matter of your survival up to the person who's already threatening you with deadly force. Now, I'm not telling you to comply with the robbery or not comply with the robbery. I just want you to make an informed decision. And here's an example that popped up on my Twitter feed just today. 35-year-old man William Grover Carter was robbed by three men who jump out of a car. I'll play that video in just a moment. And they robbed him, and then they shot him and killed him. And here is that video.
Norristown police say a man was leaving his friend's house to get something from his car. Security footage shows the moment three people step out of that gray Toyota RAV4, charge at the man, firing at least one shot.
We were chilling in the house, and we were literally sitting watching YouTube.
So that the rest is just the news report. But that guy complied with a robbery by three people, and they shot him anyway. So compliance does not guarantee you a good outcome. So you might want to document today's show. If you're a law self-defense member, you'll be able to download the PDF of the transcript of today's show as an example of where compliance does not work. Compliance leads to a bad outcome for the defender. What's another strategy that could be pursued here? Well, of course, there could be self-defense. Self-defense, of course, being defined by the elements of self-defense: innocence, imminence, proportionality, avoidance, and reasonableness. These are the maximum number of elements in a claim of self-defense. There's not 500, there's not 50, there's only up to 5 required elements of a claim of self-defense in order for that claim to be justified. They are all required, however. They are cumulative. So if any one of them can be defeated by the prosecution, the burden is on the prosecution to disprove any one of the required elements beyond a reasonable doubt, then your claim of self-defense collapses. Now, not all 5 are always required. It's common, for example, for the element of avoidance here to be legally waived because 39 states don't impose a generalized legal duty to retreat before you can defend yourself, but some do. And the element of avoidance can be reacquired if you're use of force was not otherwise lawful self-defense. For example, if you were or could be made to look as if you were the initial aggressor, then you have reacquired a legal duty to retreat because you need to withdraw from the fight to regain your innocence. So what do these mean in a nutshell? Innocence, that you cannot have been the initial aggressor in the fight, the first to threaten or use force. Imminence, that the threat you're defending yourself against is either actually occurring or immediately about to occur. It's not some past offense. It's not some future speculative threat. Proportionality, that you're not using deadly force unless you're facing a deadly force threat. Avoidance, this is those 11 states that are duty to retreat states. In those states, you have a legal duty to retreat, if safely possible, before you can use force in self-defense. And reasonableness, 2 parts to reasonableness: a subjective, genuine belief in the need to act in self-defense, and objective reasonableness, a theoretical reasonable and prudent person in your circumstances would have shared your subjective belief. And a good example of a state that frames its self-defense law in this way is Massachusetts. So Massachusetts, interestingly enough, does not have self-defense statutes. It's a very old state, obviously. Its self-defense law is found in case law, court decisions, not in statutes. So I can't show you a Massachusetts self-defense statute. They don't really have those. But we do have the jury instructions. So that's what I'll share with you here today. And you'll also see that the jury instructions don't precisely match the sequence of the five elements as I described them, but they are all there. There's five paragraphs relevant to this discussion on self-defense in the Massachusetts jury instruction. The first covers subjective reasonableness and genuine good faith belief in the need to act in self-defense, and they combine imminence in there. The second paragraph covers objective reasonableness. The third covers avoidance. The fourth, proportionality. And the fifth, innocence. And we'll look at each of those. So, and the way Massachusetts frames this is by explicitly placing the burden on the state. So the Commonwealth, the state, satisfies its burden of proving that the defendant did not act in proper self-defense if it proves any of the following four propositions beyond a reasonable doubt. In essence, if it disproves any one of these elements here. If the state can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not actually believe, subjective reasonableness, that he was in immediate danger of death or serious bodily injury. That's subjective reasonableness and imminence. And the whole show today, folks, we're just focusing on deadly force because that's what was used in the video. The second paragraph, if the state can prove that a reasonable person in the same circumstances as the defendant would not have reasonably believed he was in immediate danger of death or serious bodily injury. So that's objective reasonableness. The third paragraph, the defendant did not use or attempt to use all proper and reasonable means under the circumstances to avoid physical combat before resorting to the use of deadly force. That's the element of avoidance. Fourth paragraph, the defendant used more force than was reasonably necessary under all the circumstances. That's the element of proportionality. And the or of the Commonwealth can prove that the defendant was the first to use or threaten deadly force. That's the element of innocence under Massachusetts law. So how does that play out in our video here? Well, early on, of course, we have, let me get back to the presentation of the knife here.
There, yeah.
Whoops. So at this moment, are all those elements of self-defense soundly on the side of the biker? He's not the first to use or threaten force, so he has innocence. The threat is occurring right now or imminently about to occur because the knife is right there. That's imminence. It's a deadly force threat. That's proportionality. I would suggest he can't safely avoid that knife simply by the knife is too close. So avoidance is not practically possible. It would not be a reasonable means of attempting to avoid combat. So that satisfies the element of avoidance. If he's in one of the 11 states, that would impose the element of avoidance. Again, 39 states do not. And reasonableness. Does he have a genuine good faith belief that he's facing a deadly force threat? We can all agree that would be true. And is that belief reasonable? Well, he's not imagining the knife, right? He's not thinking, well, this guy could have a knife for all I know. The knife is actually being displayed and he's perceiving it rationally. So if the biker had pulled out a gun at this point, with all those five elements in his favor, he'd be acting in lawful self-defense. But here's the problem. He doesn't shoot at this point. He doesn't shoot until the bad guy is on the bike. Or about to get on the bike. In this moment, when he actually brings his gun into play, is the rider in this moment facing an imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury? He's not. He's not anymore. Now, is there a property crime taking place? Yes, but Massachusetts does not allow for the use of deadly force to stop a property crime. It only allows for the use of deadly force when there's a threat to persons. Now, often a property crime involves a threat to persons. A moment ago, there was a threat to persons, but there isn't now in the moment when this rider resorts to deadly force. So under Massachusetts law, there would be no justification here because Massachusetts self-defense does not encompass this scenario. But there are states that do. Whoops. And that brings us to the, yeah, Massachusetts has no independent provision to use deadly force to prevent a forcible felony in the absence of an imminent threat to persons. And it has no independent justification to use deadly force to defend property. But some states do. Some states not only have a privileged use force in defense of persons against unlawful deadly force harm, but also to prevent forcible felonies. And one of those is Florida. So this is Florida Statute 776-012. It's Florida's core self-defense statute. And the deadly force provision reads, a person is justified in using or threatening to use deadly force if he reasonably believes that using or threatening to use such force is necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm to himself or herself or another person. So that's the classic five elements of self-defense are right in there. Or a parallel justification for the use of deadly force on another is to prevent the imminent commission of a forcible felony. Now, is armed robbery a forcible felony? Well, any kind of robbery is a forcible felony under Florida law. Here's the Florida statute that defines forcible felony, 776.08. Forcible felony means treason, murder, manslaughter, sexual battery, carjacking. This is a motorcycle jacking, home invasion robbery, or robbery, and then a bunch of other enumerated felonies. So can you use deadly force under Florida law to prevent the imminent commission of a robbery? And the answer would be yes. Now, some might argue that the robbery's over at this point. So he could have used deadly force to prevent the taking of the motorcycle, but not at the point, at this point, where the shooting actually occurs. I would suggest that's not a very strong argument because the robbery is still in progress. The robbery is not completed until the robber has secured the property from the scene. And that's not happened here yet. So I would suggest under Florida law, this would be a lawful shooting because Florida encompasses not just the use of deadly force to prevent harm to persons, but also to prevent forcible felonies. What about defense of property? What about if there was no knife, there was no robbery? This rider had just been inside the house and he left his motorcycle out by the street. And then he sees some strange dude starting to roll his motorcycle away. And he runs out there to stop him. Could he just shoot him from the house to prevent the theft of his property? Well, not in 49 states, but in one state, arguably, he could. And that state is Texas, because Texas is uniquely the one state that allows for the use of deadly force to protect property, even in the absence of a threat to persons and even in the absence of a felony taking place. And that statute, Penal Code Section 9.42, deadly force to protect property, it reads, a person is justified in using deadly force against another to protect tangible, movable property. And then it has a bunch of conditions that have to be met. So let's see if the conditions would be met here. The first is that he'd be justified in using non-deadly force to protect the property. That's what Section 9.41 is referring to there. Let's assume for purposes of discussion that that's satisfied, that he would definitely be privileged to use non-deadly force to prevent the taking of his motorcycle. The next condition is not only does he have to have been privileged to use non-deadly force, but he has to reasonably believe that the deadly force is immediately necessary. And then we have two alternative ways to satisfy this condition to prevent the other's imminent commission of arson, burglary, robbery, aggravated robbery, theft during the nighttime, or criminal mischief during the nighttime. Well, is this robbery? Obviously, this is an imminent commission of a robbery. So we've already satisfied this paragraph two, but just to take a quick look at the other way to satisfy paragraph two, to prevent the other who is fleeing immediately after committing burglary, robbery, aggravated robbery, or theft during the nighttime from escaping with the property. So even if we had to deal with the argument of someone saying, well, you know, the robbery's over here, well, Texas covers that by explicitly allowing for the use of deadly force in defense of property to prevent someone who was fleeing immediately after committing the robbery. And then paragraph three is the last set of conditions, alternative conditions, and that the defender reasonably believes the property cannot be protected or recovered by any other means. I think we know if the robber gets away with the motorcycle, it'll never be seen again. Or that the use of force other than deadly force to protect or recover the property would expose the actor to a substantial risk of death or serious bodily harm. I think we know that to be true, right? Because the robber here has presented a knife, has already threatened the rider with deadly force. So I would suggest that under Texas law, you have a unique defense of property argument. So we have these four legally sound justifications or legally sound options here, right? Compliance, just letting it go, but that doesn't guarantee your safety, does it? Self-defense, if the conditions of your state's self-defense law have been met. In Massachusetts, they would not be here when these shots were fired. Forcible felony defense, as we saw under Florida law, assuming that the robbery still being in commission is sufficient to meet the requirements of the Florida forcible felony law. And then defense of property uniquely in Texas, because Texas is the one state that allows for the use of deadly force in defense of personal property. And a motorcycle here would be personal property. One other rationale. And this really circles back to self-defense, the self-defense narrative. This motorcycle theft is occurring on, looks like just a residential street. There's plenty of homes. There's other people around. But in the old days of the Wild West, horse thieves could be hung and were hung. And why? Why would we allow for the use of deadly force against a horse thief, someone who stole, and a horse would be personal property? Because the rules for the use of deadly force in the Wild West were not tremendously different than what we have today. Still basically founded on the five elements of self-defense that we talk about. Well, the reason, of course, is that if you're out in the Wild West and you're scores of miles away from civilization, and the only way to get to a place of safety is on your horse, and someone steals your horse from you, you're dead. You're going to die out there. Now, are you facing an imminent threat of death when they take your horse? Arguably not, but there are two ways to define imminence. The common way, as we already discussed, is that the threat you're facing, the danger you're facing, is actually occurring or immediately about to occur. If you were to see someone, I don't know, you went down to you got off your horse and walked 100 yards away to look at a creek. And then you see someone's taking your horse that you left behind, tied to a tree, but now they're taking your horse. You're 100 yards from them. They're not pointing a gun at you. They're not presenting any imminent threat to you. They're simply committing a property crime by taking your horse. So there is no imminent threat there in the sense of it's actually occurring or immediately about to occur. But the other way to look at imminence is that the danger would otherwise be inevitable and unavoidable. So you're not going to die right then, but you are doomed to die if the theft of your horse is completed. And that makes the taking of the horse an imminent threat. So this motorcycle rider is not in that circumstance. But I can tell you that I very often ride my motorcycle in places like vacant parts of the Rocky Mountains, up in open terrain in Canada, where I am literally 100 miles, 200 miles from any place that could be considered shelter or safety. And if someone were to steal my motorcycle under those circumstances, I think I would be presented with that imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury, in the sense of my death would be otherwise unavoidable absent the motorcycle. And that therefore would present an imminent deadly force threat in that context. Now, don't worry, folks. Don't worry. So I do carry an emergency transponder with me when I go on these trips, so I can contact a satellite for safety, for rescue. That assumes, of course, that the bad guys don't take my transponder, which I would make hard to do. All right. So those are the various. That's not what I wanted to do. Here we go. Now it is time for the Q&A portion of the show, which means that all of you watching on YouTube and Twitter and Rumble, your stream is about to end. Sorry about that, but the Q&A portion of the show is for Law of Self-Defense members only. The good news is It's dirt cheap to be a law of self-defense member. You can become one for just 99 cents, folks. 99 cents gets you a 2-week trial, unlimited access to all our member benefits, all the members-only portions of the shows, the transcripts of every show that we do that you can download for your own records to document your specialized knowledge, make it admissible in court if you're ever compelled to defend yourself in court on a use of force charge. All that and much more. Try it out for 99 cents. Download a bunch of PDFs. It's fine with me. And if you stay a member after the 2-week trial, it's still less than $10 a month, about 30 cents a day to be a Law of Self-Defense member. But at least try it out for 99 cents. LawofSelfDefense.com/trial or scan that QR code there on the screen. LawofSelfDefense.com/trial. Now, if you are a Law of Self-Defense member and you're watching this on the member dashboard, don't go anywhere. In about 20 seconds, we'll be back to continue with the Q&A portion of the show. If you're watching on YouTube, Twitter, or Rumble, it's been fun, and I'll see you guys next time.